Let's head to Tokoroa to meet an aviation enthusiast with a huge YouTube following. 69-year-old Bruce Simpson has two YouTube channels with more than 440,000 subscribers. He posts videos featuring remote-controlled model aircraft and drones. You can see some of it on our webpage, rnz.co.nz/9to-noon. His two channels, XJet and RC Model Reviews, have attracted over 140 million views. I asked Bruce Simpson if he ever foresaw this when he started out.
No, not really. I was interested in it and I was an early adopter, so I just started uploading videos and then the whole thing took off.
Can you explain to people what it is that you put up on the web and how you do it, just so they can visualise?
Well, it's quite varied. It's a bit eclectic, but basically I fly model aircraft at local airfield, and I've been posting videos about that on one of my channels, and it's turned into sort of a regular program almost. There's a group of characters that I film and have a lot of fun. It's quite entertaining for many people, and then we have other special things that happen at the airfield that I tend to film as well. And the other channel I have is where I review products which are related to drones and the hobby of flying model aircraft, and I do a little bit of science and electronic theory as well. Some of my most popular videos are whiteboard videos on my RC Model Reviews channel.
People love this stuff. They absolutely love this stuff. But let's give people an idea of why they love yours so much. How was your recent clip, Russian helicopter, received?
Yeah, that was a bit of engineering on my part. With the conflict in Ukraine, there just happened to have been a very, very highly detailed scale model of a helicopter flying at an event at the airfield here recently. So I had filmed it in a way that made it look quite realistic. So then I uploaded it and didn't tell people it was a model until the end, which was kind of a surprise, but that sort of got on the algorithm. People were looking for things related to Ukraine, and there was a lot of footage of the conflict in Ukraine. So people kind of jumped on that, and you know, over a million views very quickly. And the interesting thing is that I discovered later some news channels, one news broadcaster in India had used that footage as being real footage from the Ukraine conflict. So it's a crazy world.
It's a crazy world, but it also says something to your skills. And can you explain a little bit more about how you made it so realistic? You're using a model, right? But what's the sort of skill that you bring to making it look that realistic that someone thought it was the real thing?
Well, I've been doing this now for I don't know how many years, since 2006. So that's 18 years, I think. And so I've developed a lot of techniques with camera use and editing and production and so forth, whereas I use camera angles and effects that really do make these things look much bigger than they are. But it was a very large model helicopter to start with.
And also, well, how big was it, by the way? People will be curious.
I'm not sure. In terms of, it was probably across the rotors, it would have been 1.5 metres, maybe 2 metre rotor span.
That's a decent size for a model, isn't it?
Yeah, because probably weighed 35 kilos at least, I would think.
So that's interesting when we think about what you do on the drone side of things. Just how far has that technology come? You know, when I'm thinking model aircraft, I'm thinking back to my childhood, you know, and the aficionados, but with quite small models and quite limited range. But just how sophisticated has it got with drone technology?
Well, it's very sophisticated now. The advances in technology have been made in leaps and bounds. And some of the models that I film have real jet engines in them, which was something unheard of. Even, you know, 10 years ago, it was very difficult to power a model with a real jet engine. But now all the communications equipment and we have cameras and all sorts of things, so you can fly them with goggles on. It's an amazingly fast-moving hobby. And that's one of the reasons that I started my RC Model Reviews channel, because a lot of people who were older people didn't understand the technology. And a lot of people like myself, when I was I dabbled with radio controlled models when I was a kid, but then life gets in the way, you have families, you move around. So I didn't get back into it until about 2000. And I had to get up to speed myself with all the technology. So I thought, well, I'll share that knowledge with others. And I started the channel to show others what the technology was and how to use it. And that's why I think that channel became very popular.
Look, those how-tos, whether it's DIY, I've watched them on gardening, I've watched that amazing and had a guest, an amazing American guest who would do all his own do-it-yourself stuff, the filming techniques, the editing, the techniques, you know, the time lapse, all this stuff, and they're addictive and they're really, really informative. So let's come back. So you've got a really quite sophisticated model of the Russian helicopter. Then you've got the filming skills, camera angles, lighting, editing. People are sophisticated, you know. They'll spot your errors and they'll spot a moment of unreality. Is there a heck of a lot of editing that goes into this as well? And you're a perfectionist on that front.
Yeah, I tend to take pride in my work, and I might... one video, which might be 2 minutes long, might take me a week to make when you include the filming and then the editing and polishing and just getting everything dead right. You can put a lot of effort. You can put as much effort as you like into it. At some stage, you've got to say, this is good enough. But yeah, a lot of my videos take an awfully large amount of time.
Now, we've also got an international live stream from 9 to midday every week. I'm not sure how happy I am about the competition, but that's okay. And how's that taken off?
Well, that's actually a weekly stream that I appear on a panel of industry experts with quotes around them, where we discuss the drone industry, what's happening in the industry and where things are headed. So it's kind of a panel where we sort of provide news and what we like to think is informed commentary on events that are happening at both a hobby level and at a commercial industrial level. And yeah, that's really busy. It's done with a crowd called SUAS News, who are one of the leading online news providers in the unmanned aerial aircraft industry.
Just remind us of the scale of this industry now. I mean, actually, we're talking about military aircraft in the form of a helicopter. Drones as part of military paraphernalia now are absolutely at the forefront, right, of what you might call precision targeting, precision strikes, etc. And just how sophisticated is the craft used in the military?
Oh, they are... Actually, well, they're very sophisticated in some regards, but quite primitive in other ways. Some of the model stuff that you see is actually a little bit more clever than some of the military stuff. Military stuff has to be built so that anyone can use it. So sometimes they, you know, they're not as capable, but they are very easy to use. And this stuff now, it's replacing manned aircraft. We've seen in the conflict in the Ukraine just how effective drones have been for the little guy versus the Goliath. The drones have just changed the balance of power immensely over there. And it is the way of the future. It's going to get more so.
You can come at this from an aerodynamics point of view, from a mechanical point of view, and then of course there's the computer programming that goes into them. Is the computer programming what is getting more and more sophisticated?
Yeah, basically aerodynamics hasn't changed. The air is still the air and things still move the same way through it. So what's really changed are the power systems. We've got electric flight now, which wasn't possible just 20 years ago. We didn't have the batteries or the motors to do that. But now everything is basically electric. And we have the video systems, which can give us high definition pictures over a very long distance. And computer programming, of course, we've got GPS. There's multiple GPS systems. And so these things can navigate themselves and do all sorts of stuff we could have only dreamed of just a few decades ago. And it's just, every year, things get even more sophisticated.
What else are the real, where else is the real sort of frontier when it comes to the use of drone technology? We've been talking a lot recently about use in agriculture, for example, but where are some of the more surprising areas that it really is making big gains, automating things that used to be done by people, or just really, you know, improving productivity?
Well, a lot of it's been overstated. This whole thing about drone deliveries, people are still waiting for their pizzas to be delivered by drones. It will never happen. I know that Google is running some tests in various parts of the world, but we will not have your Amazon purchase delivered by drone because it's just not practical. And also drones don't like flying in the rain and in strong winds. There are too many limitations. But we do have benefits where we need to go into places that it would be unsafe to put people in. And little things like surveying crops and doing actual land surveys, that sort of thing. Sometimes it's more economic to use a drone than to use a manned aircraft. But I think having been involved in this industry since its inception, it's grossly overstated. Every year people make these wildly outrageous claims about how the drone industry will be worth so many billions of dollars. And it never comes to fruition because so many people out there are selling a dream, not actually selling a product. Every time there's a new press release, it's full of computer-generated 3D renderings and all these promises. And 5 years down the track, that company generally has wound up and gone insolvent because they couldn't deliver. It's a lot of hype in this industry.
What was your entree to it? I think by training you're an electronics engineer, but what got you involved and when?
Well, as I say, when I was young, I played around with model aircraft and then got out of it quite some time. And it wasn't until 2000 or so that I got back in. And that was just before drones started being, I think, consumer drones, you know, your DJI, Mavics and Phantoms and things. So I had I had an interest and I was building stuff, and I found it fascinating how these drones flew. So I just learned more about it, built some myself. And then because I had built up a base of knowledge and understanding and experience, I was actually getting approached by companies from overseas to help them out with problems they had. And it sort of went from there. And it's a fascinating area of engagement. And every day I learn something new and enjoy it.
You've had quite a varied working life though, yeah?
Well, to be honest, I've never worked a day in my life, because everything I do, I enjoy. I consider work as something you have to do in order to earn enough money to have fun on the weekends, but I enjoy what I do. So it's not work to me. It's something that I do that I get paid for.
So the electrical engineering, computer programming, there've been businesses, there's been business startups too?
Yep. I started way back in 1997. I started an online news service, which that was long before the internet was a big thing. And by the time I sold it in 2000 or 1999, it was the world's most widely syndicated web-based news service. It was the news from that website appeared on over 250,000 other web pages all around the internet. It was more popular, in fact, than Playboy.com, which is a great brag. But it was one of those things that I saw an opportunity. I sat down and there was a problem I solved. And then I commercialized it and I sold the business.
Classic engineer's mindset: problem, get it solved. 7am.com it was called. What happened to it? Because obviously we've had this explosion now of online news, but what happened to it after you sold it?
Well, I was offered $1 million US by a company called LookSmart, which was a division of Reader's Digest in America. And this was in the dot-com boom, so anything was worth a lot of money. But I didn't want it to actually leave New Zealand, because I thought it was a great demonstration of how we could box above our weight and how distance wasn't an issue when you were dealing with the internet. In fact, I was asked, I appeared at one of the APEC conferences in 1999, I think it was, because the government of the day was heralding this as a great example of New Zealand doing great things on the internet. And then I found some local investors who were prepared to buy half share of the company. Unfortunately, I made a very poor choice, because one of those investors was David Ross, and I think we know what happened to David Ross of late, and they sort of ran it into the ground, wouldn't listen, and so eventually it just folded up.
Yes, that is an interesting sort of side story. There's been a few side stories to life for you, of course, as there is with any proactive and entrepreneurial life. And the early adopter trait keeps coming through. We were a pretty early adopter also of YouTube.
Yeah, I started in, I think, 2006, when it was just a curiosity rather than the major video on demand platform. And I've always, been early adopter, because I love experimenting. Learning new things is a big thing for me. I love learning stuff. And if you tend to be out there looking for new stuff, you tend to adopt new technologies, new ideas, new concepts very readily. And it's a great way also from a business perspective. If you are early onto the scene, you've got more opportunity to spot a problem, create a solution for it, monetize it, and enjoy the profits.
Now, there have been many ventures and adventures along the way. At some point, you built a jet engine.
Yeah, I actually built a low-cost cruise missile in my garage when I lived up north of Auckland, because I saw the potential for this technology to be misused. I wanted to prove that you could build something that was effectively a cruise missile without having to get any military-grade equipment. I bought all the stuff from local hardware suppliers and eBay and put this thing together. And, of course, that didn't go down too well with the American government, who thought that I was trying to make cruise missiles to sell to people. It was a very interesting period in my life, let's put it that way.
What did happen?
Well, in the end, the paper or the news caught hold of this, and there was articles in the BBC and on CNN and the Herald, and all the news media loved this story because it was kind of quirky, I suppose, and also demonstrated that there was a risk. I then caught the attention of the US government, and the Prime Minister of the day, Helen Clark, had actually said earlier that I wasn't breaking any laws, wasn't breaking any rules. It was actually quite legal to build a cruise missile in your own garage as long as you didn't use it. But that wasn't good enough for the American government, who I think came in and said this project must be stopped. And because it had already been declared that I was doing nothing illegal, other methods were used to shut down my project. But I'd achieved the goal of alerting people to the potential for this kind of technology to be misused.
Is that still a great risk, a grave risk, as we again come back to worrying about a nuclear Armageddon. It was the shadow over my childhood. And now, of course, with the conflict happening and some of the rhetoric and hyperbole anyway surrounding that, people worry again. But do we often look at the big players and think less about the protections we need around the small players?
Yeah, I think I was sort of like 20 years ahead of my time in raising this awareness of the risk. And I'm so lucky that I was wrong. Nobody did militarize or use this technology for evil in the Western world, which is great. I'm so glad they didn't. But now, of course, you can go down to the shop and buy a drone, and people are saying, oh, you could put a bomb on it, you could use it to do whatever. But the fact is that people don't. This whole phobia of drones has been built around hyperbole. And it's an interesting fact that very few people concede in terms of safety is that there is not one person ever been killed through the recreational use of a multi-rotor drone anywhere in the world at any time. They are the safest form of aviation that has ever existed. So now that we're aware of the risk, it's being managed and people are not being endangered.
Let's come back to the filming of the YouTube clips that are getting such a following. Most of this happens at Tokoroa Airfield, and is this simply because it's the local?
Yeah, it's a local airfield, and also it is virtually unused by manned aviation. It's one of the complaints I've had with our local council. It's a fantastic asset, and it's so underutilised that why should ratepayers be paying for something that's hardly even used? So model aircraft is the primary use of that airfield. It's a lovely sealed runway in the middle of the central Upper North Island, but it's mainly used for model aircraft and training drivers.
Are you seeing the YouTube success having something of an unexpected tourism spin-off? Is it drawing attention to Tokoroa, bringing people there?
Absolutely. Before COVID was a thing, we were getting a couple of hundred people a year who came to Tokoroa solely to get a selfie in front of the control tower to meet the people that they'd seen on YouTube and see the airfield they'd seen on YouTube. And now that the borders are opening again, I've already had emails from people saying, we're coming next year and we're going to drop in and see you. So, yeah, it's a fantastic. It's almost like Lord of the Rings does this for Matamata, and I think I do it for Tokoroa.
Bruce Simpson is our guest, has two YouTube channels with more than 440,000 subscribers. And of course, we were mentioning the earlier example of the videos that had a million tuning in, something like over 100 million views on the two channels, XJet and RCM Model Reviews. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. I'm interested in whether people with your early adoption mindset and this mindset of where's the problem, how do I solve it, are born or made, and the old debate. If you could look back to your own childhood and either your own experiences then, your own nature then, or what it was that helped nurture this kind of curiosity and putting it into action, could you comment?
I don't know. I've never really contemplated that. I know that as a kid, I was just a traditional geeky kid, you know, and I guess I was always reading books or in the library. And that, you know, it's sort of a thirst, a desire to learn new stuff. And once you get in that mindset, of course, it naturally follows on that you're going to use that knowledge to do certain things.
And education-wise, this is another thing. Sometimes less is more with people who have very creative or very entrepreneurial mindsets. Did you follow a traditional sort of educational path?
Pretty much so. I mean, I went to school, went to high school, and then I studied electronics as an apprentice. I was an apprentice electronics repair person, and then I did engineering, and I ended up actually some of the time I spent teaching at a polytech level computer programming and electronics in Rotorua for a little while back in the 1980s. But I sort of self-teach myself on a lot of stuff. And as you said, YouTube is a fantastic resource. You can learn anything you want by going online these days. And I'm a little bit disappointed that with all this potential out there, anyone can upskill themselves to almost any level. We tend to spend far too much time watching cute cat videos instead.
It's such a good point. And we are talking about really highly skilled people, whether it's repairing things or, as I said, a lot of the construction side of stuff is absolutely fascinating. And these are often very highly skilled individuals and, like you, very professional in the way they go about making their YouTube product.
Yeah, I think it's you can be whatever you want to be, and you determine your own future. That's one of my outlooks, is that, you know, life is what you want to make it. And so I don't... anyone who's well educated has a bit of an advantage, but you don't have to be, you know, highly educated. You just have to be motivated and work hard.
Another key new tech media enterprise of yours was being pretty early off the mark as a blogger as well. How long has your blog been running, aardvark.co.nz?
Over 27 years now. I started it back in 1995. Again, that was just, I had some information that I wanted to share with people because I was in the industry and there were lots of people on the border of the industry and there was no one sort of connecting everybody together. So I started publishing this. It was originally a weekly publication, then it moved to daily, and then it's just grown from there. And it's also been somewhat of a rock because no matter what else has happened in my life, every morning I get up and I write my daily, every weekday morning, I write my daily blog. So it is an anchor point. Everything else goes from there. It's the one piece of consistency no matter what else is happening.
Are you able to pay the bills from these enterprises? We know some with high subscription YouTube channels do very, very nicely. For you, has it been able to fund the way you want to live, the stage of your life?
Yeah, it's not about the money for me. I've never been money-centric. I've always, as I've said, I haven't needed money because I enjoy every day. I don't have to work hard so I can spend money on toys to enjoy the weekend. Every day is a weekend to me because I'm doing what I like. In terms of revenues from YouTube, I am very, I don't focus on the money. For example, if you watch a YouTube video, most videos will have ads through them and it's really annoying. I simply have ads at the beginning of my videos. I do not have the mid-roll ads. I would rather make sure that people watching my videos had a good experience than focus too much on picking their pockets. Likewise, a lot of YouTube creators these days have sponsorships and they run affiliate links in their videos. I don't do any of that because I want people who watch my videos to enjoy the video from start to end without distraction. And in the case of my review channel, I don't want anyone thinking that there's some kind of commercial imperative that might skew the objectivity of what I'm telling them. I'm not going to try and sell them something. I'm giving them totally objective data because I'm not going to make a penny out of it if they buy the product.
I read somewhere that you don't draw your pension. You're eligible to now, but you don't draw your pension. And that's obviously you're able, as you say, to fund yourself without, you know, trying to get rich. But is there another philosophical reason for that?
Yeah, I was always taught that, you know, you don't take any more than you need. And that's my philosophy. Now, I could draw down on the pension. A lot of people consider it a right to draw their pension. I look at the pension as a safety net. If I need it, I'll draw it, but I don't need it. So I don't see why I should be spending money that really should be going to someone in much greater need than myself. And so, yeah, it's a principle thing. I just like to live my life by certain principles, and that's one of them. I don't get rich from my YouTube, but I live in Tokoroa, so it's pretty cheap to live here. I don't have to earn a lot of money to pay the bills.
You mentioned that the writing every day is a constant in life, no matter what else is going on. And have there been times when you're really grateful for that anchor in your life?
Oh, certainly. Like everybody's life, mine's had its ups and downs. And for example, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's about 3 or 4 years ago, and that took a while to sink in. But it was quite sobering to realise your mortality has been defined, and being able to keep writing. And also a lot of the people, I've been doing this for 27 years, a lot of the people who read it today were there at the beginning. So it's almost like a little family of people that respond in the forums and we engage. And it's great to have that sort of backup and support from the people that I write for.
And with the Parkinson's, I imagine just listening to you, you'd have, thrown everything at learning everything you can about that.
Yeah, I did. I've read so many medical papers on Parkinson's and I looked at so many of the options for treatment, and everyone was saying you should have cannabis, but I've got enough problems without getting in trouble with the police. So I looked at it and I lost weight. I started doing strength exercises. I'm actually stronger, fitter, healthier now in terms of my physical form than I've ever been. I lost 20 kilos and put on 8 kilos of muscle. It was great. And I feel so good. But the things march on inexorably, and I have muscle cramps. I don't sleep very well. So I'm aware that my body's changing, and I just develop coping strategies to manage it. One of the biggest things has been trying to film video with a handheld camera when you've got tremors. But I've worked around that.
Bruce, I imagine the people are a big part of this as well, whether it's the people participating in the channels, people you're interacting with around the channels, or with the model aircraft, as we said, at Tokoroa, which seems to be the capital for it. I'm curious, actually, with the borders opening, is there going to be an influx of international model aircraft enthusiasts, some of them drawn by what they've seen from you?
Yeah, I'm sure there will be. It was interesting. A few years ago, because the airfield itself is so rarely used for full-size aviation, I floated the prospect of creating an international model park there. And so many people were coming and expressed an interest in coming. I thought, well, why don't we build an attraction, somewhere where they can actually come and have models they can fly? And I actually did a crowdfunder and raised $40,000 from around the world to set up a model park at the Tokoro Airfield. Unfortunately, the council didn't want a bean of it and said, we're not interested. So that never happened. But there's huge potential for that sort of thing. That's a hobby tourism is becoming, or was very large before COVID, and it will become large again.
I've got the feeling that there'll be an opportunity to revive that proposal. Are you still determined to make it happen?
I'd love to make it happen. Unfortunately, dealing with council, you might say I'm a polarising personality. People tend to love me or hate me, and unfortunately the council seem to have taken the hate me option. So I don't get on too well with the council, but who knows, things may change. There's elections coming, you know, everything changes.
Bruce Simpson, do view some of his work on our webpage, rnz.co.nz/9toNoon. Also, you can find out where his channels are if you want to follow up more.